wind. With difficulty, one rasping step at a time, she slowly advanced. But she did advance. Geralt grew uneasy. He did not expect such a simple sign to paralyze the Strigger entirely, but neither did he expect the beast to overcome it so easily. He could not hold the sign for long, it was too exhausting, and the Strigger had no more than 10 steps to go. He lowered the sign suddenly and sprung aside. The Strigger, taken by surprise, flew forward, lost her balance, fell, slid along the floor, and tumbled down the stairs into the crypt's entrance, yawning in the floor. Her infernal scream reverberated from below. To gain time, Geralt jumped onto the stairs leading to the gallery. He had not even climbed halfway up when the Strigger ran out of the crypt, speeding along like an enormous black spider. The Witcher waited until she had run up the stairs after him, then leapt over the balustrade. The Strigger turned on the stairs, sprang and flew at him in an amazing 10-meter leap. She did not let herself be deceived by his pirouettes this time. Twice her talons left their mark on the Rivian's leather tunic. But another desperately hard blow from the silver-spiked gauntlet threw the Strigger aside, shook her. Geralt, feeling fury building inside him, swayed, bent backwards, and with a mighty kick knocked the beast off her legs. The roar she gave was louder than all the previous ones. Even the plaster crumbled from the ceiling. The Strigger sprang up, shaking with uncontrolled anger and lust for murder. Geralt waited. He drew his sword, traced circles with it in the air, and skirted the Strigger, taking care that the movement of his sword was not in rhythm with his steps. The Strigger did not jump. She approached slowly, following the bright streak of the blade with her eyes. Geralt stopped abruptly, froze with his sword raised. The Strigger, disconcerted, also stopped. The Witcher traced a slow semicircle with the blade, took a step in the Strigger's direction, then another. Then he leapt, feigning a whirling movement with his sword above her head. The Strigger curled up, retreated in a zigzag. Geralt was close again, the blade shimmering in his hand. His eyes lit up with an ominous glow. A hoarse roar tore through his clenched teeth. The Strigger backed away, pushed by the power of concentrated hatred, anger and violence which emanated from the attacking man, and struck her in waves, penetrating her mind and body. Terrified and pained by feelings unknown to her, she let out a thin, shaking squeak, turned on the spot and ran off in a desperate, crazy escape down the dark tangle of the palace's corridors. Geralt stood quivering in the middle of the hall. Alone. It had taken a long time, he thought, before this dance on the edge of an abyss, this mad, macabre ballet of a fight had achieved the desired effect. Allowed him to physically become one with his opponent, to reach the underlayers of concentrated will which permeated the Strigger. The evil, twisted will from which the Strigger was born. The Witcher shivered at the memory of taking on that evil to redirect it, as if in a mirror, against the monster. Never before had he come across such a concentration of hatred and murderous frenzy, not even from basilisks, who enjoyed a ferocious reputation for it. All the better, he thought, as he walked towards the crypt entrance and the blackness that spread from it like an enormous puddle. All the better, all the stronger was the blow received by the Strigger. This would give him a little more time until the beast recovered from the shock. The Witcher doubted whether he could repeat such an effort. The elixirs were weakening, and it was still a long time until dawn. But the Strigger could not return to her crypt before first light, or all his trouble would come to nothing. He went down the stairs. The crypt was not large. There was room for 3 stone sarcophagi. The slab covering the first was half pushed aside. Geralt pulled the 3rd vial from beneath his tunic, quickly drank its contents, climbed into the tomb and stretched out in it. As he had expected, it was a double tomb, for mother and daughter. He had only just pulled the cover closed when he heard the Strigger's roar again. He lay on his back next to Adda's mummified corpse and traced the sign of Irden on the inside of the slab. He laid his sword on his chest, stood a tiny hourglass filled with phosphorescent sand next to it, and crossed his arms. He no longer heard the Strigger screams as she searched the palace. He had gradually stopped hearing anything as the True Love and Celandine began to work. Part 7. When Geralt opened his eyes, the sand had passed through the hourglass, which meant his sleep had been even longer than he had intended. He pricked up his ears and heard nothing. His senses were now functioning normally. He took hold of his sword and, murmuring an incantation, ran his hand across the lid of the sarcophagus. He then moved the slab slightly, a couple of inches. Silence. He pushed the lid further, sat, holding his weapon at the ready, and lifted his head above the tomb. The crypt was dark, but the Witcher knew that outside dawn was breaking. He struck a light, lit a miniature lamp, and lifted it, throwing strange shadows across the walls of the crypt. It was empty. He scrambled from the sarcophagus, aching, numb, cold. And then he saw her. She was lying on her back next to the tomb, naked and unconscious. She was rather ugly, slim with small pointed breasts and dirty. Her hair, flaxen red, reached almost to her waist. Standing the lamp on the slab, he knelt beside her and leant over. Her lips were pale, and her face was bloody where he had hit her cheekbone. Geralt removed his gloves, put his sword aside, and without any fuss, drew up her top lip with his finger. Her teeth were normal. He reached for her hand, which was buried in her tangled hair. Before he took it, he saw her open eyes. Too late. She swiped him across the neck with her talons, cutting him deeply. Blood splashed onto her face. She howled, striking him in the eyes with her other hand. He fell on her, grabbing her by the wrists, nailing her to the floor. She gnashed her teeth, which were now too short, in front of his face. He butted her in the face with his forehead and pinned her down harder. She had lost her former strength. She could only writhe beneath him, howling, spitting out blood. His blood, which was pouring over her mouth. His blood was draining away quickly. There was no time. The Witcher cursed and bit her hard on the neck, just below the ear. He dug his teeth in and clenched them until her inhuman howling became a thin, despairing scream, and then a choking sob. The cry of a hurt 14-year-old girl. He let her go when she stopped moving, got to his knees, tore a piece of canvas from his sleeve pocket and pressed it to his neck. He felt for his sword, held the blade to the unconscious girl's throat, and leant over her hand. The nails were dirty, broken, bloodied, but normal. Completely normal. The Witcher got up with difficulty. The sticky, wet greyness of early morning was flooding in through the crypt's entrance. He made a move towards the stairs, but staggered and sat down heavily on the floor. Blood was pouring through the drenched canvas onto his hands, running down his sleeve. He unfastened his tunic, slit his shirt, tore and ripped rags from it, and tied them around his neck, knowing that he didn't have much time, that he would soon faint. He succeeded, and fainted. In Vichim, beyond the lake, a cock, ruffling his feathers in the cold damp, crowed hoarsely for the third time. Part 8. He saw the whitened walls and beamed ceiling of the small chamber above the guardroom. He moved his head, grimacing with pain, and moaned. His neck was bandaged, thickly, thoroughly, professionally.
"Lie still, Witcher," said Velerad. "Lie. Do not move."
"My sword."
"Yes, yes, of course. What is most important is your witcher's silver sword. It's here, don't worry. Both the sword and your little trunk, and the 3,000 orins. Yes, yes, don't utter a word. It is I who am an old fool and you the wise witcher. Foltest has been repeating it over and over for the last 2 days."
"Two?"
"Oh, yes, two. She slit your neck open quite thoroughly. One could see everything you have inside there. You lost a great deal of blood. Fortunately, we hurried to the palace straight after the third crowing of the cock. Nobody slept in Vychim that night. It was impossible. You made a terrible noise. Does my talking tire you?
The princess.
The princess is like a princess. Thin, and somewhat dull-witted. She weeps incessantly and wets her bed, but Foltest says this will change. I don't think it will change for the worse. Do you, Geralt?
The Witcher closed his eyes.
Good. I take my leave now. Rest.
Velerad got up.
Geralt, before I go, tell me, why did you try to bite her to death? Eh, Geralt?
The Witcher was asleep. The Voice of Reason 2, Part 1.
Geralt?
He raised his head, torn from sleep. The sun was already high and forced blinding golden rays through the shutters, penetrating the chamber with tentacles of light. The Witcher shaded his eyes with his hand in an unnecessary instinctive reflex which he had never managed to shake off. All he needed to do, after all, was narrow his pupils into vertical slits.
It's late, said Nemica, opening the shutters. You've slept in.
Off with you, Yola.
The girl sat up suddenly and leant out of bed to take her mantle from the floor. Geralt felt a trickle of cool saliva on his shoulder where her lips had been a moment ago.
Wait, he said hesitantly.
She looked at him, quickly turned away. She had changed. There was nothing of the water nymph in her anymore, nothing of the luminous, chamomile-scented apparition she had been at dawn. Her eyes were blue, not black, and she had freckles on her nose, her neckline, her shoulders. They weren't unattractive, they suited her complexion and reddish hair. But he hadn't seen them at dawn, when she had been his dream. With shame, he realized he felt resentment towards her, resentment that she hadn't remained a dream, and that he would never forgive himself for it.
Wait, he repeated. Yola, I wanted...
Don't speak to her, Geralt, said Denica. She won't answer you anyway. Off with you, Yola.
Wrapped in her mantle, the girl pattered towards the door, her bare feet slapping the floor, troubled, flushed, awkward, no longer reminding him in any way of Yennefer.
Nenneke, he said, reaching for his shirt, I hope you're not annoyed that you won't punish her, will you?
Fool, the priestess snorted. You've forgotten where you are. This is neither a hermitage nor a convent. It's Melitela's temple. Our goddess doesn't forbid our priestesses anything. Almost.
You forbade me to talk to her.
I didn't forbid you, but I know it's pointless. Yola doesn't speak.
What?
She doesn't speak. She's taken a vow. It's a sort of sacrifice through which... What's the point of explaining? You wouldn't understand anyway. You wouldn't even try to understand. I know your views on religion. No, don't get dressed yet. I want to check your neck.
She sat on the edge of the bed and skillfully unwound the linen bandages wrapped thickly around the witcher's neck. He grimaced in pain. As soon as he had arrived in Elander, Nenneke had removed the painfully thick stitches of shoemaker's twine with which they had stitched him in Vychim, opened the wound and dressed it again. The results were clear. He had arrived at the temple almost cured, if perhaps a little stiff. Now he was sick again and in pain. But he didn't protest. He'd known the priestess for years and knew how great was her knowledge of healing, how rich and comprehensive her pharmacy was. A course of treatment at Melitele's temple could do nothing but good. Nenneke felt the wound, washed it and began to curse. He already knew this routine by heart. She had started on the very first day and had never failed to moan when she saw the marks left by the princess of Vychim's talons.
It's terrible to let yourself be slashed like this by an ordinary strigger. Muscles, tendons, she only just missed your carotid artery. Great Melitele! Geralt, what's happening to you? How did she get so close to you? What did you want with her? To mount her?
He didn't answer and smiled faintly. Don't grin like an idiot.
The priestess rose and took a bag of dressings from the chest of drawers. Despite her weight and low stature, she moved swiftly and gracefully.
There's nothing funny about it. You're losing your reflexes, Geralt.
You're exaggerating.
I'm not exaggerating at all.
Neneke spread a greenish mush smelling sharply of eucalyptus over the wound.
You shouldn't have allowed yourself to get wounded, but you did, and very seriously at that, fatally even. And even with your exceptional powers of regeneration, it'll be months before your neck is fully mobile again. I warn you, don't test your strength by fighting an agile opponent during that time.
Thank you for the warning. Perhaps you could give me some advice, too. How am I supposed to live in the meantime? Rally a few girls, buy a cart and organise a travelling house of ill repute.
Neneke shrugged, bandaging his neck with quick, deft movements.
Am I supposed to give you advice and teach you how to live? Am I your mother or something?
Right, that's done. You can get dressed. Breakfast's waiting for you in the refectory.
Hurry up or you'll have to make it yourself. I don't intend to keep the girls in the kitchen to midday.
Where will I find you later? In the sanctuary?
No. Neneke got up. Not in the sanctuary. You're a welcome guest here, Witcher, but don't hang around in the sanctuary. Go for a walk, and I'll find you myself.
Fine.
Part 2 Geralt strolled, for the fourth time, along the poplar alley, which led from the gate to the dwellings by the sanctuary and main temple block, which merged into the sheer rock. After brief consideration, he decided against returning to shelter and turned towards the gardens and outbuildings. Umpteen priestesses, clad in grey working garments, were toiling away, weeding the beds and feeding the birds in the henhouses. The majority of them were young or very young, virtually children. Some greeted him with a nod or a smile in passing. He answered their greetings, but didn't recognise any of them. Although he often visited the temple, once or even twice a year, he never saw more than three or four faces he knew. The girls came and went, becoming oracles in other temples, midwives and healers specialising in women's and children's diseases, wandering druids, teachers or governesses. But there was never a shortage of priestesses arriving from all over, even the remotest regions. Melitele's temple in Elanda was well known and enjoyed well-earned fame. The cult of Melitele was one of the oldest, and in its day, one of the most widespread cults from time immemorial. Practically every pre-human race and every primordial nomadic human tribe honoured a goddess of harvest and fertility, a guardian of farmers and gardeners, a patroness of love and marriage. Many of these religions merged into the cult of Melitele. Time, which was quite pitiless towards other religions and cults, effectively isolating them in forgotten, rarely visited little temples and oratories buried amongst urban buildings, had proved merciful to Melitele. She did not lack either followers or sponsors. In explaining the popularity of the goddess, learned men who studied this phenomenon used to hark back to the pre-cults of the Great Mother, Mother Nature, and pointed to the links with nature's cycle, with the rebirth of life and other grandiloquently named phenomena. Geralt's friend, the troubadour Dandilian, who enjoyed a reputation as a specialist in every possible field, looked for simpler explanations. Melitele's cult, he deduced, was a typical woman's cult. Melitele was, after all, the patroness of fertility and birth. She was the guardian of midwives, and a woman in labour has to scream. Apart from the usual cries, usually promising never to give herself to any bloody man ever again in her life, a woman in labour has to call upon some godhead for help, and Melitele was perfect. And since women gave birth, give birth, and will continue to give birth, the goddess Melitele, the poet proved, did not have to fear for her popularity.
Geralt.
Neneke, I was looking for you.
Me?
The priestess looked at him mockingly.
Not Yola?
Yola too, he admitted. Does that bother you?
Right now, yes. I don't want you to get in her way and distract her. She's got to get herself ready and pray if something's to come of this trance.
I've already told you, he said coldly. I don't want any trance. I don't think a trance will help me in any way.
While I, Neneke winced, don't think a trance will harm you in any way. I can't be hypnotized. I have immunity. I'm afraid for Yola. It might be too great an effort for a medium. Yola isn't a medium or a mentally ill soothsayer. That child enjoys the goddess's favour. Don't pull silly faces, if you please. As I said, your view on religion is known to me. It's never particularly bothered me, and no doubt it won't bother me in the future. I'm not a fanatic. You've a right to believe that we are governed by nature and the force hidden within her. You can think that the gods, including my Melitele, are merely a personification of this power, invented for simpletons so they can understand it better, accept its existence. According to you, that power is blind. But for me, Geralt, faith allows you to expect what my goddess personifies from nature. Order, law, goodness, and hope.
I know.
If you know that, then why your reservations about the trance? What are you afraid of? That I'll make you bow your head to a statue and sing canticles? Geralt, we'll simply sit together for a while. You, me, and Yola. And see if the girl's talents will let us see into the vortex of power surrounding you. Maybe we'll discover something worth knowing. And maybe we won't discover anything. Maybe the power and fate surrounding you won't choose to reveal themselves to us, will remain hidden and incomprehensible. I don't know. But why shouldn't we try?
Because there's no point. I'm not surrounded by any vortex or fate. I never were. Why the hell would I delve into it?
Geralt, you're sick.
Injured, you mean?
I know what I mean. There's something not quite right with you. I can sense that. After all, I have known you ever since you were a youngster. When I met you, you came up to my waist. And now I feel that you're spinning around in some damned whirlpool, tangled up in a slowly tightening noose. I want to know what's happening. But I can't do it myself. I have to count on Yola's gifts.
You want to delve too deeply? Why the metaphysics? I'll confide in you if you like. I'll fill your evenings with tales of ever more astounding events from the past few years. Get a keg of beer so my throat doesn't dry up and we can start today. But I fear I'll bore you, because you won't find any nooses or vortexes there, just the witch's ordinary tales.
I'll willingly listen to them. But a trance, I repeat, would do no harm.
Don't you think, he smiled, that my lack of faith makes such a trance pointless?
No, I don't. And do you know why?
No.
Neneke leant over and looked him in the eyes, with a strange smile on her pale lips.
Because it would be the first proof I've ever heard of that a lack of faith has any kind of power at all.
A Grain of Truth. Part 1. A number of black points, moving against a bright sky, streaked with mist, drew the witch's attention. Birds. They wheeled in slow, peaceful circles, then suddenly swooped and soared up again, flapping their wings. The witcher observed the birds for a long time, then, bearing in mind the shape of the land, density of the wood, depth and course of the ravine which he suspected lay in his path, calculated the distance to them, and how long he would take to cover it. Finally, he threw aside his coat and tightened the belt across his chest by two holes. The pommel and hilt of the sword, strapped across his back, peeked over his shoulder.
"We'll go a little out of our way, Roach," he said. "We'll take a detour from the highway. I don't think the birds are circling there for nothing."
The mare walked on, obedient to Geralt's voice.
"Maybe it's just a dead elk," said Geralt. "But maybe it's not. Who knows?"
There was a ravine, as he had suspected. The witcher scanned the crowns of the trees, tightly filling the rift. But the sides of the gully were gentle, the riverbed dry and clear of blackthorns and rotting tree trunks. He crossed it easily. On the other side was a copse of birches, and behind it a large glade, heath and undergrowth, which threw tentacles of tangled branches and roots upwards. The birds, scared away by the appearance of a rider, soared higher, croaking sharply in their hoarse voices. Geralt saw the first corpse immediately. The white of the sheepskin jacket and matte blue of the dress stood out clearly against a yellowing clump of sedge. He didn't see the second corpse, but its location was betrayed by three wolves sitting calmly on their haunches, watching the Witcher. His mare snorted, and the wolves, as if at a command, unhurriedly, trotted into the woods, every now and again turning their triangular heads to watch the newcomer. Geralt jumped off his horse. The woman in the sheepskin and blue dress had no face or throat, and most of her left thigh had gone. The Witcher, not leaning over, walked by her. The man lay with his face to the ground. Geralt didn't turn the body over, seeing that the wolves and birds hadn't been idle, and there was no need to examine the corpse in detail. The shoulders and back of the woolen doublet were covered with thick black rivulets of dried blood. It was clear the man had died from a blow to the neck, and the wolves had only found the body afterwards. On a wide belt next to a short cutlass in a wooden sheath, the man wore a leather purse. The Witcher tore it off, and item by item, threw the contents on the grass. A tinderbox, a piece of chalk, sealing wax, a handful of silver coins, a folding shaving knife with a bone handle, a rabbit's ear, three keys, and a talisman with a phallic symbol. Two letters written on canvas were damp with rain and dew, smudged beyond readability. The third, written on parchment, was also ruined by damp, but still legible. It was a credit note made out by the dwarves' bank in Murivel to a merchant called Rulla Asper, or Aspen. It wasn't for a large sum. Bending over, Geralt lifted the man's right hand. As he had expected, the copper ring digging into the swollen blue finger carried the sign of the Armourer's Guild, a stylized helmet with visor, two crossed swords, and the rune A engraved beneath them. The Witcher returned to the woman's corpse. As he was turning the body over, something pricked him in the finger. A rose pinned to the dress. The flower had withered, but not lost its colour. The petals were dark blue. Very dark blue. It was the first time Geralt had seen such a rose. He turned the body over completely and winced. On the woman's bare and bloody neck were clear bite marks, and not those of a wolf. The Witcher carefully backed away to his horse. Without taking his eyes from the forest edge, he climbed into the saddle. He circled the glade twice and, leaning over, looked around, examining the ground closely. "So, Roach," he said quietly, "the case is reasonably clear. The armourer and the woman arrived on horseback from the direction of the forest. They were on their way home from Murivel, because nobody carries an uncashed credit note for long. Why they were going this way and not following the highway, I don't know. But they were crossing the heath side by side, and then, again, I don't know why, they both dismounted, or fell from their horses. The armourer died instantly. The woman ran, then fell and died, and whatever attacked her, which didn't leave any tracks, dragged her along the ground with her throat in its teeth. The horses ran off. This happened 2 or 3 days ago." The mare snorted restlessly, reacting to his tone of voice. "The thing which killed them," continued Geralt, watching the forest's edge, "was neither a werewolf nor a leshy. Neither would have left so much for the scavengers. If there were swamps here, I'd say it was a kikimora or a viper. But there aren't any swamps here." Leaning over, the Witcher pulled back the blanket which covered the horse's side and uncovered another sword strapped to the saddlebag, one with a shining, ornate guard and black corrugated hilt. "Well, Roach, we're taking a roundabout route. We better check why this armourer and woman were riding through the forest, not along the highway. If we pass by ignoring such incidents, we won't ever earn enough for your oats, will we?" The mare obediently moved forward across the heath, carefully sidestepping hollows. "Although it's not a werewolf, we won't take any risks," the Witcher continued, taking a bunch of dried monk's head from a saddlebag and hanging it by the bit. The mare snorted. Geralt unlaced his tunic a little and pulled out a medallion engraved with a wolf with bared jaws. The medallion, hanging on a silver chain, bobbed up and down in rhythm to the horse's gait, sparkling in the sun's rays like mercury. Part 2. He noticed the red tiles of the tower's conical roof from the summit of a hill as he cut across a bend in the faint trail. The slope, covered with hazel, dry branches, and a thick carpet of yellow leaves, wasn't safe to descend on horseback. The Witcher retreated, carefully rode down the incline, and returned to the main path. He rode slowly, stopped the horse every now and again, and, hanging from the saddle, looked out for tracks. The mare tossed her head, neighed wildly, stamped and danced on the path, kicking up a storm of dried leaves. Geralt, wrapping his left arm around the horse's neck, swept his right hand, the fingers arranged in the sign of Axia, over the mount's head as he whispered an incantation.
"Is it as bad as all that?" he murmured,
looking around and not withdrawing the sign.
"Easy, Roach, easy!"
The charm worked quickly, but the mare, prodded with his heel, moved forward reluctantly, losing the natural springy rhythm of her gait. The Witcher jumped nimbly to the ground and went on by foot, leading her by the bridle. He saw a wall. There was no gap between the wall and the forest, no distinct break. The young trees and juniper bushes twined their leaves with the ivy and wild vines clinging to the stonework. Geralt looked up. At that same moment, he felt a prickle along his neck, as if an invisible soft creature had latched onto his neck, lifting the hairs there. He was being watched. He turned around smoothly. Roach snorted, the muscles in her neck twitched, moved under her skin. A girl was standing on the slope of the hill he had just climbed down, one arm resting on the trunk of an alder tree. Her trailing white dress contrasted with the glossy blackness of her dishevelled hair, falling to her shoulders. She seemed to be smiling, but she was too far away to be sure.
"Greetings," he said,
raising his hand in a friendly gesture. He took a step towards the girl. She turned her head a little, following his movements. Her face was pale, her eyes black and enormous. The smile, if it had been a smile, vanished from her face as though wiped away with a cloth. Geralt took another step. The leaves rustled underfoot, and the girl ran down the slope like a deer, flitting between the hazel bushes. She was no more than a white streak as she disappeared into the depths of the forest. The long dress didn't appear to restrict her ease of movement in the least. Roach neighed anxiously, tossing her head. Geralt, still watching the forest, instinctively calmed her with the sign again. Pulling the mare by the bridle, he walked slowly along the wall, wading through burdock up to the waist. He came to a sturdy gate with iron fittings and rusty hinges, furnished with a great brass knocker. After a moment's hesitation, Geralt reached out and touched the tarnished ring. He immediately jumped back, as at that moment the gate opened, squeaking, clattering, and raking aside clumps of grass, stones, and branches. There was no one behind it. The Witcher could only see a deserted courtyard, neglected and overgrown with nettles. He entered, leading Roach. The mare, still stunned by the sign, didn't resist, but she moved stiffly and hesitantly after him. The courtyard was surrounded on three sides by a wall and the remains of some wooden scaffolding. On the fourth side stood the mansion, its façade mottled by a pox of chipped plaster, dirty damp patches, and festooned with ivy. The shutters, with their peeling paint, were closed, as was the door. Geralt threw Roach's reins over the pillar by the gate, and slowly made his way towards the mansion, following the gravel path past a small fountain full of leaves and rubbish. In the centre of the fountain, on a fanciful plinth, a white stone dolphin arched, turning its chipped tail upwards. Next to the fountain, in what, a very long time ago, used to be a flower bed, grew a rose bush. Nothing but the colour of the flowers made this bush unique, but the flowers were exceptional. indigo, with a faint shade of purple on the tips of some of the petals. The witcher touched one, brought his face closer and inhaled. The flowers held the typical scent of roses, only a little more intense. The door and all the shutters of the mansion flew open at the same instant with a bang. Geralt raised his head abruptly. Down the path, scrunching the gravel, a monster was rushing straight at him. The witcher's right hand rose as fast as lightning above his right shoulder, while his left jerked the belt across his chest, making the sword hilt jump into his palm. The blade, leaping from the scabbard with a hiss, traced a short, luminous semicircle and froze, the point aiming at the charging beast. At the sight of the sword, the monster stopped short, spraying gravel in all directions. The witcher didn't even flinch. The creature was humanoid, and dressed in clothes which, though tattered, were of good quality, and not lacking in stylish and useless ornamentation. His human form, however, reached no higher than the soiled collar of his tunic, for above it loomed a gigantic, hairy, bear-like head with enormous ears, a pair of wild eyes, and terrifying jaws full of crooked fangs, in which a red tongue flickered like flame.
"Flee, mortal man!"
the monster roared, flapping his paws but not moving from the spot.
"I'll devour you, tear you to pieces!"
The witcher didn't move, didn't lower his sword.
"Are you deaf? Away with you!"
The creature screamed, then made a sound somewhere between a pig's squeal and a stag's bellowing roar, making the shutters rattle and clatter and shaking rubble and plaster from the sills. Neither witcher nor monster moved.
"Clear off, while you're still in one piece!"
roared the creature, less sure of himself.
"Because if you don't, then..."
"Then what?" interrupted Geralt. The monster suddenly gasped and tilted his monster's head.
"Look at him. Isn't he brave?"
He spoke calmly, baring his fangs and glowering at Geralt with bloodshot eyes.
"Lower that iron, if you please. Perhaps you've not realized you're in my courtyard. Or maybe it's customary, wherever you come from, to threaten people with swords in their own courtyards."
"It is customary," Geralt agreed, "when faced with people who greet their guests with a roar and the cry that they're going to tear you to pieces."
"Talk for it!"
The monster got himself worked up.
"And he'll insult me on top of it all, this straggler. A guest, is he? Pushes his way into the yard, ruins someone else's flowers, plays the lord, and thinks that he'll be brought bread and salt? Ah!"
The creature spat, gasped, and shut his jaws. The lower fangs protruded, making him look like a boar.
"So?"
The witcher spoke after a moment, lowering his sword. "Are we going to carry on standing like this?"
"And what do you suggest instead? Lying down?"
snorted the monster.
"Put that iron away, I said."
The witcher nimbly slipped the weapon into its scabbard, and, without lowering his arm, stroked the hilt which rose above his shoulder.
"I prefer you," he said, "not to make any sudden moves. This sword can always be drawn again, faster than you can imagine."
"I noticed," rasped the monster. "If it wasn't for that, you'd have been out of this gate a long time ago, with my boot print on your ass. What do you want here? How did you get here?"
"I got lost," lied the witcher.
"You got lost?"
repeated the monster, twisting his jaws in a menacing grin.
"Well, unlose your way. Out of the gate, turn your left ear to the sun, and keep walking, and you'll soon get back to the highway. Well, what are you waiting for?"
"Is there any water?" asked Geralt calmly. "The horse is thirsty, and so am I, if that doesn't inconvenience you."
The monster shifted from one foot to the other and scratched his ear.
"Listen, you," he said. "Are you really not frightened of me?"
"Should I be?"
The monster looked around, cleared his throat, and yanked up his baggy trousers.
"Pox on it! What's the harm of a guest in the house? It's not every day I meet someone who doesn't run away or faint at the sight of me." "All right, then. If you're a weary but honest wanderer, I invite you in. But if you're a brigand or a thief, then I warn you, this house does what I tell it to. Within these walls, I rule.
He lifted his hairy paw. All the shutters clattered against the wall once more, and deep in the dolphin's stone gullet, something rumbled.
I invite you in, he repeated.
Geralt didn't move, scrutinizing him. Do you live alone?
What's that to do with you?
Said the monster angrily, opening his jaws, then croaked loudly.
Oh, I see. No doubt you'd like to know whether I've got 40 servants, all as beautiful as me. I don't. Well, pox, are you going to make use of my generous invitation? If not, the gate's over there.
Geralt bowed stiffly.
I accept your invitation, he said formally. I won't slight the right of hospitality.
My house is your house,
the monster said in return, just as formally, although a little offhandedly.
This way, please, dear guest, and leave the horse here by the well.
The interior was in need of extensive repair, although it was reasonably clean and tidy. The furniture had been made by skilled craftsmen, if a very long time ago. A pungent smell of dust hung in the dark rooms.
Light!
Growled the monster, and the torch in its iron bracket burst into flames and sooty smoke.
Not bad, remarked the witcher.
The monster cackled.
That's it. I see you won't be amazed by any old trick. I told you this house obeys my commands. This way, please. Careful, the stairs are steep. Light!
On the stairs, the monster turned.
What's that around your neck, dear guest?
Have a look.
The creature took the medallion in his paw, lifted it up to his eyes, tightening the chain around Geralt's neck a little.
The animal has an unpleasant expression. What is it?
My guild's badge.
Ah, you make muzzles, no doubt. This way, please. Light!
The centre of the large room, completely devoid of windows, was taken up by a huge oak table, empty apart from an enormous brass candlestick, slowly turning green and covered with trickles of hardened wax. At the monster's command, the candles lit and flickered, brightening the interior a little. One wall was hung with weapons, compositions of round shields, crossed partisans, javelins and guisarme, heavy sabres and axes. Half of the adjacent wall was taken up by an enormous fireplace, above which hung rows of flaking and peeling portraits. The wall facing the entrance was filled with hunting trophies, elks and stag antlers, whose branching racks threw long shadows across the grinning mounted heads of wild boar, bear and lynx, over the ruffled and frayed wings of eagles and hawks. The place of honour was filled by a rock dragon's head, tainted brown, damaged and leaking stuffing. Geralt examined it more closely.
My grandpa killed it, said the monster, throwing a huge log into the depths of the fireplace. It was probably the last one in the vicinity when it got itself killed. Sit, my dear guest. You're hungry?
I won't deny it, dear host.
The monster sat at the table, lowered his head, clasped his hairy paws over his stomach, muttered something while twiddling his enormous thumbs, then suddenly roared, thumping the table with his paw. Dishes and platters rattled like pewter and silver, chalices jingled like crystal. There was a smell of roast meat, garlic, marjoram and nutmeg. Geralt did not show any surprise.
Yes!
The monster rubbed his hands.
This is better than servants, isn't it? Help yourself, dear guest. Here is some fowl, here some boar ham, here a tureen of... I don't know what, something. Here we have some hazel grouse. Pox, no, it's partridge. I got the spells muddled up. Eat up, eat up. This is proper, real food, don't worry.
I'm not worried.
Geralt tore the fowl in two.
I forgot, snorted the monster, that you're not timid. What shall I call you?
Geralt. And your name, dear host?
Nivellen, but they call me Degan or Fanger around here, and they use me to frighten children.
The monster poured the contents of an enormous chalice down his throat, after which he sank his fingers in the terrine, tearing half of it from the bowl in one go.
"Frightened children," repeated Geralt with his mouth full. "Without any reason, no doubt." "Of course not. Your health, Geralt."
"And yours, Nivellen."
"How's the wine? Have you noticed that it's made from grapes and not apples? But if you don't like it, I'll conjure up a different one."
"Thank you. It's not bad."
"Are your magical powers innate?"
"No. I've had them since growing this trap, that is. I don't know how it happened myself, but the house does whatever I wish. Nothing very big. I can conjure up food, drink, clothes, clean linen, hot water, soap. Any woman can do that, and without using magic at that. I can open and close windows and doors. I can light a fire. Nothing very remarkable."
"It's something."
"And this trap, as you call it, have you had it long?"
12 years.
"How did it happen?" "What's it got to do with you? Pour yourself some more wine."
"With pleasure. It's got nothing to do with me. I'm just asking out of curiosity."
"An acceptable reason," the monster said, and laughed loudly. "But I don't accept it. It's got nothing to do with you, and that's that. But, just to satisfy your curiosity a little, I'll show you what I used to look like. Look at those portraits. The first from the chimney is my father. The second, pox only knows. And the third is me. Can you see it?"
Beneath the dust and spiderwebs, a nondescript man with a bloated, sad, spotty face and watery eyes looked down from the painting. Geralt, who was no stranger to the way portrait painters tended to flatter their clients, nodded.
"Can you see it?"
repeated Nivellen, baring his fangs.
"I can."
"Who are you?"
"I don't understand."
"You don't understand?"
The monster raised his head. His eyes shone like a cat's.
"My portrait is hung beyond the candlelight. I can see it, but I'm not human. At least, not at the moment. A human looking at my portrait would get up, go closer, and no doubt have to take the candlestick with him. You didn't do that, so the conclusion is simple. But I'm asking you plainly, are you human?"
Geralt didn't lower his eyes.
"If that's the way you put it," he answered after a moment's silence. "Then, not quite."
"Ah, surely it would be tactless if I ask, in that case, what you are."
"A witcher."
"Ah,"
Nivellen repeated after a moment.
"If I remember rightly, witches earn their living in an interesting way. They kill monsters for money."
"You remember correctly."
Silence fell again. Candle flames pulsated, flicked upwards in thin wisps of fire, glimmering in the cut crystal chalices. Cascades of wax trickled down the candlestick. Nivellen sat still, lightly twitching his enormous ears.
"Let's assume," he said finally, "that you draw your sword before I jump on you. Let's assume you even manage to cut me down. With my weight, that won't stop me. I'll take you down through sheer momentum, and then it's teeth that'll decide. What do you think, Witcher? Which one of us has a better chance if it comes to biting each other's throats?"
Geralt, steadying the carafe's pewter stopper with his thumb, poured himself some wine, took a sip, and leaned back into his chair. He was watching the monster with a smile, an exceptionally ugly one.
"Yes," said Nivellen slowly,
digging at the corner of his jaws with his claw.
"One has to admit you can answer questions without using many words. It'll be interesting to see how you manage the next one. Who paid you to deal with me?"
"No one. I'm here by accident."
"You're not lying by any chance?"
"I'm not in the habit of lying."
"And what are you in the habit of doing? I've heard about witches. They abduct tiny children, whom they feed with magic herbs. The ones who survive become witches themselves, sorcerers with inhuman powers. They're taught to kill, and all human feelings and reactions are trained out of them. They're turned into monsters in order to kill other monsters. I've heard it said it's high time someone started hunting witchers, as there are fewer and fewer monsters, and more witchers. Do have some partridge before it's completely cold.
Nivellen took the partridge from the dish, put it between his jaws, and crunched it like a piece of toast, bones cracking as they were crushed between his teeth.
"Why don't you say anything?"
he asked indistinctly, swallowing.
"How much of the rumours about you witches is true?"
"Practically nothing."
"And what's a lie?"
"But there are fewer and fewer monsters."
"True, there's a fair number of them."
Nivellen bared his fangs.
"One is sitting in front of you, wondering if he did the right thing by inviting you in. I didn't like your guild badge right from the start, dear guest."
"You aren't a monster, Nivellen," the witcher said dryly.
"Pox! That's something new. So, what am I? Cranberry pudding? A flock of wild geese flying south on a sad November morning? No, maybe I'm the virtue that a miller's buxom daughter lost in spring. Well, get out, tell me what I am. Can't you see I'm shaking with curiosity?"
"You're not a monster. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to touch this silver tray, and in no way could you hold my medallion."
"Ha!"
Nivellen roared, so powerfully the candle flames fell horizontal for a moment.
"Today, very clearly, is a day for revealing great and terrible secrets. Now I'm going to be told that I grew these ears because I didn't like milky porridge as a child."
"No, Nivellen," said Geralt calmly. "It happened because of a spell. I'm sure you know who cast that spell."
"And what if I do?"
"In many cases, a spell can be uncast."
"You, as a witcher, can uncast spells in many cases?"
"I can. Do you want me to try?"
"No, I don't."
The monster opened his jaws and poked out his tongue, two span long and very red.
"Surprised you, hasn't it?"
"That it has," admitted Geralt.
The monster giggled and lounged in his armchair.
"I knew that would," he said. "Pour yourself some more, get comfortable, and I'll tell you the whole story. Witcher or not, you've got an honest face, and I feel like talking. Pour yourself more."
"There's none left."
"Pox on it!"
The monster cleared his throat, then thumped the table with his paw again. A large earthenware demijohn in a wicker basket appeared next to the two empty carafes from nowhere. Nivellen tore the sealing wax off with his teeth.
"As no doubt you've noticed," he began, pouring the wine, "this is quite a remote area. It's a long way to the nearest human settlement. It's because, you see, my father, and my grandfather too in his time, didn't make themselves particularly loved by our neighbours or the merchants using the highway. If anyone went astray here, and my father spotted them from the tower, they lost, at best, their fortune. And a couple of the nearer settlements were burnt because father decided the levies were being paid tardily. Not many people liked my father, except for me, naturally. I cried awfully when what was left of my father, after a blow from a two-handed sword, was brought home on a cart one day. Grandpa didn't take part in robbery anymore because, ever since he was hit on the head with the Morning Star, he had a terrible stutter. He dribbled and rarely made it to the privy on time. As their heir, I had to lead the gang. I was young at the time," Nivellen continued, "a real milkshop, so the lads in the crew wound me around their little fingers in a flash. I was as much in command of them as a fat piglet is of a pack of wolves. We soon began doing things which father would never have allowed had he been alive. I'll spare you the details and get straight to the point. One day we took ourselves as far as Gellibor near Mert and robbed a temple. A young priestess was there too."
"Which temple, Nivellen?"
"Pox only knows, but it must have been a bad one. There were skulls and bones on the altar, I remember, and a green fire was burning. It stank like nobody's business. But to the point. The lads overpowered the priestess and stripped her, then said I had to become a man. Well, I became a man, stupid little snot that I was. And while I was achieving manhood, the priestess spat into my face and screamed something.
What?
That I was a monster in human skin. That I'd be a monster in a monster's skin. Something about love, blood, I can't remember. She must have had the dagger, a little one, hidden in her hair. She killed herself, and then... we fled from there, get out. I'm telling you, we nearly wore our horses out. It was a bad temple.
Go on.
Then it was as the priestess had said. A few days later, I woke up, and as the servants saw me, they screamed and took to their heels. I went to the mirror. You see, Geralt, I panicked, had some sort of an attack. I remember it almost through a haze.
To put it briefly, corpses fell. Several. I used whatever came to hand, and I'd suddenly become very strong. And the house helped as best it could. Doors slammed, furniture flew in the air, fires broke out. Whoever could get out ran away in a panic. My aunt and cousin, the lads from the crew. What am I saying? Even the dogs howled and cowered. My cat, Glutton, ran away. Even my aunt's parrot kicked the bucket out of fear. I was alone, roaring, howling, going mad, smashing whatever came to hand, mainly mirrors.
Nivellen paused, sighed and sniffed.
When the attack was over, he resumed after a while, it was already too late. I was alone. I couldn't explain to anyone that only my appearance had changed, that although in this horrible shape, I was just a stupid youngster, sobbing over the servants' bodies in an empty manner. I was afraid they'd come back and kill me before I could explain. But nobody returned.
The monster grew silent for a moment and wiped his nose on his sleeve.
I don't want to go back to those first months, Geralt. It still leaves me shaking when I recall them. I'll get to the point. For a long time, a very long time, I sat in the manor, quiet as a mouse, not stirring from the place. If anyone appeared, which rarely happened, I wouldn't go out. I'd tell the house to slam the shutters a couple of times, or I'd roar through the gargoyle, and that was usually enough for the would-be guest to leave in a hurry. So that's how it was, until one day I looked out of the window one pale dawn, and what did I see? Some trespasser stealing a rose from my aunt's bush. And it isn't just any old rosebush. These are blue roses from Nazaire. It was grandfather who brought the seedlings. I flew into a fury and jumped outside. The fat trespasser, when he got his voice back, he'd lost it when he saw me, squealed that he only wanted a few flowers for his daughter, that I should spare him, spare his life and his health. I was just ready to kick him out of the main gate, when I remembered something. Stories Linka, my nanny, the old bag, used to tell me. Pox on it, I thought. If pretty girls turn frogs into princes, or the other way round, then maybe... maybe there's a grain of truth in these stories. A chance. I leapt 4 yards. Roared so loud, wild vine tumbled from the wall, and I yelled, "Your daughter or your life!" Nothing better came to mind. The merchant, for he was a merchant, began to weep, then confessed that his daughter was only 8. "Are you laughing?" "No." I didn't know whether to laugh or cry over my shitty fate. I felt sorry for the old trader. I couldn't watch him shake like that. I invited him inside, made him welcome, and when he was leaving, I poured gold and precious stones into his bag. There was still a fair fortune in the cellar,